Right, the importance of Hegel, I think, is that he is in the generation after Kant. Hegel was born in 1770. Kant died in 1804. But Kant really had conquered the German intellectual world by the 1790s. And so that means that Hegel is an extremely sharp, right, philosophy student. By the time we get into the 1790s, he is in his 20s and coming into his own as a philosopher. And of course, Hegel is hugely, right, significant for 19th and 20th century, right, philosophy. And almost all of the postmodern philosophers will hearken back to Hegel. Richard Rorty, for example, says, you know, philosophers can do whatever they want, but they will find that they have to enact with Hegel, and Hegel starts everything down a road that postmodernism really is just recognizing as the dead end, right, and realization of Hegelian philosophy. Now, Hegel is famous for dialectic, right, philosophy, kind of a dialectical idealism. One of the four famous phrases of Marx's philosophy is dialectical materialism. So they're going to disagree with the metaphysical substrate. Is it ideal or is it material? But that dialectical phrase, right, which has everybody scratching their heads a lot, is critical to both of them. Hegel gets most of the credit here, but I think he is reacting to something important in Kant. Toward the end of Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, which is really his most important work, right, epistemologically, there's a second section rather in which Kant develops the antinomies of reason, right, as he calls them. And so reason is traditionally, according to Enlightenment philosophy, supposed to be our tool that's going to enable us to figure out all of the ultimate truths, right, of the way the world works. And when we do metaphysics, we're trying to figure out, you know, is there really a God or is there not, right, really a God? Does the universe have a beginning in time or is it eternal? Is space also eternal, right, or not? Do we have free will, or is everything, right, determined? And what Kant argues in the antinomies of reason is to say that using reason, you can construct perfectly good arguments to prove both sides of those debates. You can prove that God exists. You can also prove that God doesn't exist. You can prove that the universe must have a beginning of time, and equally that it must not, right, have a beginning of time. And so he goes through, right, these antinomies of reason and shows that reason reaches contradictory conclusions. Right? Now, Kant draws an epistemological, right, inference from that. Right? That is to say, what this shows is that reason should not try to do metaphysics. Right, that what reason, when it tries to do metaphysics, is to try to figure out the way the world really is. But we can't do that, right? That reason is, so to speak, out of its depth in trying to figure out the way the world really is. And so that's why he amounts to a subjective retreat, right? Reason needs to do something more modest than try to do metaphysics. Hegel has read his Critique of Pure Reason, reads the antinomies of reason, and says, reaches a metaphysical, right, conclusion from this, right, that reason, right, reaches these contradictory conclusions about the nature of reality, but rather than seeing that as a problem, what we should do is interpret that metaphysically to say what this is showing is that reality itself really is contradictory, right? So we only have a problem with the idea that reason reaches contradictory conclusions if we think that we're not supposed to contradict ourselves, right? And traditional rational logic, going back to Aristotle, had said, you know, non-contradiction is our fundamental axiom, right? Epistemologically, logically, and so forth. And what Hegel is arguing is that we have to abandon the non-contradiction principle. We have to embrace contradiction because reality itself evolves by contradictory forces. And that's what the dialectic is. Right? It's to say that reality is a certain way, right? But then it evolves into its contradictory opposite, right? And out of the clash of those contradictions then comes a new synthesis, right? That then generates its own contradiction, right? And so forth. Now, an example then could be, you know, if you take traditional, say, religious, right, problems, you know, what's the origin of the universe? And we can say, well, God created the universe. And then we say, well, how did he do that, right? And they would say, well, God created the universe ex nihilo, right? And that's the Latin phrase for out of nothing, right? And that sounds kind of contradictory, right? Because then you've got God who is being, and then you've got nothing, right? And so somehow God out of nothing is then creating, right, the universe. And if you are a rational person or a logical person, right, you scratch your head, right, about that, and you say, well, that doesn't make any sense, right? If you take a whole bunch of nothing, you can do whatever you want with nothing, but you still got nothing, right? So God, how can I understand, right, a being, right, that is something somehow operating on nothing and coming up, it doesn't make any sense. And so logic, and Hegel rather is saying, no, that's to miss the whole point. Yes, it's a contradictory formulation, right, that's built into traditional religion, but that traditional religion really is trying to capture an essentially metaphysical truth about the universe, that the universe is built out of contradictory forces that are just beyond logical reason's capacity to understand. So we have to abandon, right, that traditional logic of non-contradiction and embrace the universe as evolving out of contradictory forces. So that's why Hegel, right, is important. He's important to Marx because Marx then gives a materialistic formulation. Then when you get five generations later, right, to the postmoderns, they're going to then be, in some cases, in most cases, giving a linguistic version of this, right? We can take language and do anything contradictory, right, out of language, right? That language eats itself, right? Or language, when you play around with it, comes out at the opposite end, and so forth. So it's just an evolving set of contradictory meanings and contradictory interpretations and contradictory, right, whatevers without end, right, and so forth. Okay. All right, so we've crossed off that one. All right, I'm going to do number 13 next. Okay.
All right.
All right, Kierkegaard and Nietzsche. Maybe the Kierkegaard part will be more relevant for the religious issues.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Okay, good to go again?
We are, yep.
Okay. So let me say a few things about Kierkegaard, right, and Nietzsche, also post-Kantian thinkers, and explicitly so. Both of them are explicitly well-read in Kant, also well-read in Hegel, Schopenhauer, and the immediate post-Kantian thinkers. Kierkegaard is mid-19th century. Nietzsche is later, right, in the 19th century. Whereas Hegel is saying, if we see, say, the antinomies of reason, or we're skeptical about reason, that we should therefore try to do metaphysics in a way that embraces dialectical contradiction. What Kierkegaard and Nietzsche are doing, Kierkegaard especially, is emphasizing the epistemological implications, right, or the knowledge, right, implications, right, for this. So what they want to say is Kant has shown that through reason, right, we can't know reality as it really is. So one possible reaction then is to say, so to speak, to hell with reason. And what we then need to do is, if we're really going to understand ourselves and understand reality, is turn to non-rational, right, methods of doing so. Turn to our feelings, turn to our passions, turn to our felt need for a non-rational religious commitment, right, and so forth. So a reinvigoration of non-rationalist or irrationalist epistemologies. So in the case of Kierkegaard, right, for example, you know, he, like Kant, was very well aware of the rise of reason, the rise of science, and the way in which it had kind of beaten up on traditional religion, right, to the point, by the time you get to the 1800s, a large segment of intellectuals and well-educated people are atheists, right? right? And saying that we don't need to understand ourselves in the world in terms of any, you know, superstition, right, and traditional dogmas. Science and will ultimately explain the world. And Kierkegaard is horrified, right, by that, because, you know, in his view, science is just going to lead to a kind of a cold, valueless, amoral, right, understanding. There's no room for passion. There's no room for the meaning of life. We're just going to have the, you know, the ultimate materialist heat death of the universe, and that's terrible. So while at the same time, rationally and logically, the new Enlightenment philosophies and the science are compelling. Right? You don't have good rational arguments against that. Religion does seem absurd. It does seem old-fashioned. But at the same time, from Kierkegaard's perspective, that's the only thing that can give us meaning, right, and value, and a sense that human beings have a destiny, right? There is genuine meaning, right, in the universe and purpose, right, in life. So we have this felt conflict between the rational side of us that says, well, there probably is no God and we can't prove it, and the emotional, passionate side of us says that we really need to commit faithfully to a religion to have right meaning in our lives. So that faith versus reason conflict, Kierkegaard is grappling right with fundamentally. And so he is Kantian in the sense that he's agreeing with Kant that we need to find a way to limit reason, or to limit knowledge, depending on which translation of that key phrase you go with, in order to make room for faith. Right? Kierkegaard desperately wants to make room, right, for faith. He has this long and influential reflection on the parable of Abraham. And Abraham is the knight of faith, right, as he calls him. And he gives a very Lutheran, right, interpretation of this, and behind that a very Augustinian, right, interpretation of that there is no way to reconcile what the proper understanding of Abraham should be, right, that he wasn't acting rationally, you know, that he wasn't thinking, well, somehow God will find a way to solve the problem here. No, God asked him to sacrifice his son Isaac, and that is absurd, right? And Kierkegaard says it is absurd, right, because God had made a promise that through Isaac, the future generations, right, of Israel would come to be. And if I kill Isaac, then he hasn't fathered children yet. That can't happen. That would mean God made a promise and we would be breaking the promise, and so he's a promise breaker. This is unjust, right? Isaac has not done anything to deserve to be killed, right? So you're asking me, God, to do an unjust thing, but God is supposed to be the source of morality and justice. This is sadistic, right? What is it like to ask a father to kill his own son? Can you imagine anything more horrific? No, you can't, right? So we say this might be a test, right, of something or other, but what kind of sadistic being is going to put anybody through that kind of test? Right? And what am I going to tell Sarah, right, my wife? Oh, God told me to kill our son. Well, it's going to torture her, right? And it's going to destroy our marriage, right, and so forth. So it's not just, it's sadistic, right? It's a promise breaking. And there is no way rationally to wrap your mind around this and come up with a fancy logical explanation for it. Abraham has to obey. That's the lesson, right? Be obedient. And for him to obey, he has to shut his reason off. He has to say, I'm not going to question God. He doesn't ask questions. Can you give me some explanation? Right? A rational person asks for explanations, right? But Abraham is not rational. Right? He does not question. He does not ask. He doesn't understand why he is doing this other than God said so. And so he is willing, without understanding, to obey and do something that he thinks is horrible, right? And that is precisely then why Kierkegaard thinks he's a good guy, right? That he's willing to do that. He's willing, ultimately, all the way down, to be a faithful and obedient human being. And if you're not willing to do that, right, the only alternative is, if you're not willing to totally make a faith commitment and obey God, then science and the Enlightenment is the alternative. But from his perspective, that's horrifying. So he's willing to make this irrational, right, faith commitment. Okay. All right. I'll stop there on that, right, just to pause. Okay.
Sure.
All right. I'll just say it's a couple more things you might want to splice in, because I know it's going to be relevant to, right, postmodern Christian theology, right? Now, that's why I think Kierkegaard is very important then to recent generations of kind of postmodern Christian thinkers, right, who are interested in drawing upon themes of postmodernism to think about how to do religion, so to speak, in this this modern world that seems to be increasingly irreligious, right, and to turn away from traditional religious approaches in various ways. And I should also mention Schleiermacher, who was of the generation prior to Kierkegaard, also, right, extremely important and influential post-Kantian theologian, also important to postmodern theology now. Okay. All right, I think that's enough on that. Okay. Yes, I've said a little bit right here. I'm saving the political ones just for the laugh. We'll do those as a unit. We've done Kant. We've done Counter-Enlightenment, Attack on Reason and Faith. Martin Heidegger. Do we want to say more about Heidegger? Well. Yeah. Hey, you.
There's no one there.
Mystery person.
Yeah.
Are you there, Tess? Oh, I thought so. Are you going to come in for a bit more? I understand, but thank you for your patience. All right, well, I'm confident we can wrap things up by 7, as promised. Okay. Are you getting hungry?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm getting hungry too. Yeah. What's your timeline for getting back to Chicago?
I'll probably go after this. I still need to get my hotel and
Okay. All right. Yeah. And driving in a strange town. I was going to say, if you want to come and grab a bite to eat with us, feel welcome. Otherwise, if you need to get going, that also is fine. I know what it's like being on the road.
Thanks.
Okay, sure. All right. So, what do I want to say about Heidegger? It's one of these guys, you can say a lot about him. How do I say a little, right, about him? I'll try to say 2 minutes on Heidegger.
Sorry.
Okay. Yeah, I'm hungry too, so we're all motivated here.
And I'm tired.
Tired and starved. Uh-oh.
And I'm bored.
And bored. This is like a perfect storm of bad things, huh? All right, I'm going to talk now for a couple minutes. Okay. Are we going?
Yep, we're
okay.
Going.
Well, yes, Martin Heidegger is another hugely important figure. I don't think he is a postmodernist, but he is a last step right toward postmodernism. Richard Rorty cites significantly the importance of Heidegger. So do both Foucault and Derrida, or the importance of Martin Heidegger. Three things I think are important right about Heidegger. One is that he is explicitly anti-rationalist right in his epistemology. And again, he is trying to do a kind of Hegelian, right, metaphysics. And in his famous "What Is Metaphysics?" essay, right, he does say essentially Hegel is right, right, in saying being and nothing are one and the same thing, however contradictory, right, that sounds. And what this just means is that we need to set aside logic if we're going to do metaphysics properly. But he's also talking about the irrationalist tradition to say that if we're going to do metaphysics properly, it's going to be through emotionalist explorations of fear and dread and angst and so forth. Heidegger is also important for his social philosophy because he is arguing that it is not as individuals that we're going to find any meaning, right, and significance, right, in our lives. Instead, we are, to use non-Heideggerian language, right, we're born into a social context, and we are acculturated, right, to that social context, and our core way of thinking and valuing and interacting, right, with the world is not socially determined. He's not quite that strong, but shapes, right, us in a very fundamental way. And so it really is impossible for anyone to find a meaningful and significant life by abandoning their cultural context. And so he has a language that, you know, is politically pregnant for reasons that we can get to, where he says that really you need to commit to your folk, right, your group, and let it be in you and work through you and do your part to extend, right, its value framework and its life and its lifestyle. So he's explicitly anti-individualistic, right, to a very strong degree. And that the notion then is picked up by various forms of postmodern identity politics, that you are, so to speak, and they have it in a stronger form, a vehicle, right, through which your various group identities that you are born into, those are the source of your identity, your value framework, and you need to embrace them, right? Let them work through you and be a vehicle through which those group identities manifest themselves in the world. That's what it is to be an authentic, right, human being. And that existentialist language that's in Heidegger is significant here. And that existentialist language that is significant in Heidegger is important here. A third thing I would say is, if you're interested in environmental movements, obviously there are many strands of environmentalism, but one of the major strands that's been influential is a postmodern deep ecology. And postmodern deep ecology explicitly draws on some of Heidegger's post-World War II writings. There's a famous turn in Heideggerian thinking from his kind of pre-World War I thinking to his World War II thinking. Pre-World War I thinking, I blew it again. There's an important turn in Heidegger's pre-World War II thinking and his post-World War II thinking. There's some commonalities, but there are some changes there. But the question of technology and some of the other essays that Heidegger is writing after World War II are the ones that the deep ecology postmodernists, and particularly the postmodern deep ecologists, are drawing on are explicitly Heideggerian. Okay. All right. I'm going to say one more thing about Heidegger. Yes.
Is this your classroom?
Yes. Yep, it is. The board right now is in the frame for the video, so we'll have to wait until after we're done. Okay. If you want to write on a board, though, feel welcome to take some of those markers. You can go to any of these other rooms and go to town.
Are they that big?
Yeah, some are bigger. How's that for a motivation, huh? And there should be three or four